Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask a question during the question-and-answer session. You may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one keys on your touch-tone phone. You may remove yourself from the queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Please note this call may be recorded. I will be standing by if you should need any assistance. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Mr. Benjamin Johnson. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being here for this teleconference. We're here to talk about the realities at the U.S.-Mexico border and the real sources of violence and how we can best respond. The purpose of this call, or really the need for this call, is generated by, I think, the way that the immigration debate has gone, not just recently, but really over the last 10 years. Over the last 10 years, this issue of border enforcement and border security has been a major focus of the immigration debate. In fact, while legislative efforts to reform other aspects of our immigration system have stalled, proposals to increase funding and personnel at the border have managed their way through Congress. As a result, there has been, again, over the last 10 years, probably 15 years now, a dramatic increase in infrastructure and money and personnel at the border. But nevertheless, this appetite for enforcement at the border seems almost insatiable. The issue continues to come up again, as other issues. The immigration system as a whole is widely understood to be flawed on many, many levels. But the focus of the legislative efforts and the debate seems to always come back to this question of border enforcement. And this issue has come up again very recently as part of the controversy surrounding Arizona's new law. Now, the way that this issue has, or the way that the Arizona law has sparked this renewed appetite for enforcement is, I think, emblematic of how this issue often comes up. That is, the Arizona law doesn't directly address border enforcement or border security at all. But border enforcement fears, border security fears are an underlying factor, certainly part of what was used in the conversations and the ramp up to passage of that law. And again, just in general, when the issue of immigration comes up, it seems that the nice low-hanging fruit that everybody wants to reach for is this question of border enforcement. So what we have really in the context of the Arizona law is this generalized fear of crime and illegality, and then a generalized response of throwing more money at the problem, particularly at the border. And what seems lost in all of this generalized fear and generalized response is a more detailed look at what is the real threat at the border. Where should our resources be focused in order to address those threats? And I guess finally, this question of does it make sense for us to continue to put on hold other immigration reform efforts while we continue to feed this appetite for border enforcement. So what we have assembled here today on our conference call is a group of people who have been looking at these issues for quite a while and experts on this subject. We have with us today Dr. David Shirk. David is the director of the Transborder Institute and conducts research and publishes on topics related to Mexican politics, U.S.-Mexican relations, and law enforcement and security issues along the U.S.-Mexican border. He is the principal investigator for the Transborder Institute's Justice in Mexico Project, which is a binational research initiative focused on criminal justice. David's been around these issues and around the border for a long time and is a real expert on this. Following Dr. Shirk will be Jennifer Bernal Garcia. Jennifer is a researcher at the Center for a New American Security. She works with senior fellow Colonel Bob Killebrew, a retired colonel who is on the Center for New American Security's Transnational Crime Project, and they focus a lot on drug trafficking organizations in the Western Hemisphere and on national security in general. So she's been around these issues doing a lot of really important research on border security and drug-related issues at the border for quite a while. And finally, Arthi Kohli will conclude our list of experts. Arthi is the Director of Immigration Policy at the Chief Justice Earl Warren Institute on Race, Ethnicity, and Diversity at the Berkeley School of Law. Her area of expertise is immigration law and policy, and she has been around these issues for a long time, including spending some time in working in the halls of Congress and seeing how this issue gets addressed legislatively or perhaps not addressed legislatively, unfortunately. So this is a subject that Arthi has also been around for a very long time and understands from many, many different perspectives. So I'm going to turn this issue over to our experts and hope that they can bring us the benefit of their insights and experience. And Dr. Shirk, let's start with you.
That sounds good. First of all, thanks for bringing together this conference call. It's amazing how quickly this issue has become a central and important concern for people on both sides of this debate. It's sort of come together very quickly in a short period of time, partly in the aftermath of the Arizona law, which has obviously generated an enormous response, but also importantly, I think we have to keep in mind as we think about this that we are in an election year, and that much of the discussion and many of the debates about this are fueled in many ways by electoral pressures, electoral politics. And lastly, I think it's really significant that much of this discussion, particularly about sending troops to the border, follows immediately on the heels of the recent state visit by President Felipe Calderon to Washington, in which he not only raised the issue of immigration and called out the Arizona law as being unfair or prejudicial to Mexicans living in the United States, in many cases illegally. He also, I think, sparked the ire of many conservatives in the United States when he brought up the issue of gun control and U.S. responsibility for much of the violence going on south of the border. The factors that have brought us to this point, we're in a situation where the President of the United States has authorized the deployment of 1,200 troops to the border, as well as additional appropriations, about $500 million to help bolster security along the border. And that measure, which would have been unthinkable, I think, for the Obama administration a year ago, is a token gesture in many ways compared to what some of the Republicans in Congress would prefer to see, 6,000 troops at the border, much more substantial resource allocations to the border. And it shows the challenging position that the Obama administration is in, sort of walking a very fine line on the border, literally and figuratively. On the one hand, he needs to preserve the executive branch's privilege and authority to make determinations about troop allocations. I mean, we're in a time of war, and Congress, in a very unprecedented way, is trying to say, well, you know, even though you've got these two wars going on in Afghanistan and Iraq, we're going to tell you how and where you need to place troops, and that needs to be on the border. The thing is, and I think going back to Ben's points in the introduction, we are at an unprecedented point in the history of the U.S.-Mexico border in terms of the level of force and capacity that we have at the U.S.-Mexico border right now. At no point since 1910, when we sent half our military to the border to protect against possible insurgency from Mexico, have we seen such a massive demonstration of federal force at the border. Back just last year, the U.S. Border Patrol reached its goal of manning the Border Patrol, staffing the Border Patrol at a level of 20,000 agents, which is up about 15% from the previous year. That's more than double the numbers that the Border Patrol had in place a decade ago. And at the same time, we've got thousands of Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, about 3,000 of those. We've got 300 National Guard troops who were already deployed by Governor Bill Richardson back in March, as well as the surge of ATF agents and others. So we have an unprecedented presence at the border. It's difficult to see how, without seriously diminishing returns, we could place many more troops at the border or many more forces at the border than we currently have. For every extra one or 10 federal forces that we put at the border, it's not clear to me that we gain a great deal more in terms of security. In fact, I mean, when you look at the data that have been published in the last few weeks about the situation at the border, many border communities, including El Paso, which is right across from Ciudad Juarez, the most violent city in the hemisphere, many U.S. border communities are safer than ever before. Levels of homicide, levels of violent crime have actually gone down very significantly. And despite a handful of isolated incidents that we can point to, it's actually quite remarkable how little we've seen the violence from Mexico's quote-unquote spill over onto the U.S. side. Now, that said, I mean, I think the issue here then is that paradoxically, placing more of a federal presence at the border has had two ironic or even unwanted effects. On the one hand, the unintended consequence of trying to place more of an emphasis on border control, while at the same time we have done very little to address demand for drugs or demand for labor by penalizing employers who hire undocumented immigrants, we've actually seen two sort of very, I think, significant and negative effects from concentrated enforcement at the border. The first is that drug trafficking organizations have actually evolved significantly from small-scale, low-level operations that they were back in the 1980s to the very highly sophisticated kinds of organizations that you need to have in order to get over, around, under the border controls we currently have. As long as that demand is untouched, the ability and the desire of these organizations to get their product across the border is going to be unscathed. And the same thing holds true for immigration. We have not done anything to really try to address the demand we have for migrant labor here in the United States, even in these very difficult economic times. There appears to be some kind of U.S. demand for undocumented labor. And the result is that we've created a cottage industry of professional smugglers who make anywhere from $1,500 to $3,000 a head moving people across the border. And paradoxically, once they get here, these migrants who used to return home on a seasonal basis, now they don't want to go home because it's too costly, it's too dangerous. And so we actually have more undocumented immigrants living in the United States today than we would have if we weren't focusing on these kinds of concentrated border enforcement mechanisms, and we're instead really trying in an earnest way to figure out what's our demand for labor in the United States, what kind of comprehensive immigration reform would be necessary to meet both the needs of our employers and to protect the rights of American workers by making sure we know who's here and who's working legally in this country. So I'll stop there because I know that others are going to go into more detail on some of these points, but I'll open that up. I'll try to open the discussion with that.
All right, David, thank you very much. Jennifer, you want to talk a little bit about the security and crime issues at the border?
Sure. Thank you so much, Ben, and thank you again for convening this panel. So as you mentioned, I studied this issue from the background of national security studies. So really it's trying to determine, you know, do we have a problem here? What is the problem, and how can the U.S. best counter it? So I'm just going to start by saying that basically it's true. It's true that the U.S. faces a problem that has national security relevance at its border. But I'm going to talk a little bit about, you know, how it's very important to really really bound that and really focus on the problem as crime and not the problem as crime and immigration and basically every basket of problems that can easily be conflated together, because that's exactly the sort of gesture that really precludes the government from adopting a proper strategy against it. So it is true that the organized crime that the U.S. faces on the other side of the border is a humongous problem. We're talking here about organizations that deal with a $60 billion industry just in terms of the the North American drug market alone. We're talking about cartels in Mexico that have developed paramilitary structures, that have made transnational links with the international mafias. We're talking about Russian crime rings and Asian crime rings and the works. This is why various government agencies, such as the Department of Justice, have very explicitly stated that drug trafficking organizations from Mexico are currently the biggest national security threat in the form of organized crime. But I think it's really important here to realize that you're talking about groups that are very sophisticated, that have very sophisticated counter-surveillance capabilities. They have sprawling structures, and it's true that they link up with local gangs, whether you're talking about the U.S. or Mexico. But by and large, they are not driven by the same motivators, and they're not the same as illegal immigrants who come here to the U.S. to work. They're not operating because of the same motivations. And now, as David mentioned a little bit, the problem with a lot of policies, best exemplified recently by the Arizona law, but really dating back several more years, is that when you enact policies without thinking about these differences, what you're only doing is driving these two groups closer together. So the focus on border enforcement in the past decade, was enacted because there was this fear of crime and violence at the border, but really what it only did is that it had the second-order effect, never considered, of only aiding these organizations, criminal organizations, to grow to the scale that we see them being today. So when you build a fence along the border instead of deterring illegal immigrants, what you're actually doing is you're making them go straight into the arms of more consolidated criminal organizations whom they then trust to know the way across. And the thing is, from a security perspective, this really doesn't make any sense. I think what you see right now is that the government doesn't apply lessons that it has learned in different settings, and most recently what it has learned in places, even, to take an extreme example, the extreme example of Afghanistan and Iraq, where the U.S. military very closely learned that really security is based on gaining the trust of a population, because you want them to give you human intelligence. You want them to help you prosecute and ultimately counter the insurgents, the people who are actually acting violently, who tend to be the organized criminal groups. And that is exactly what laws like Arizona prevent people from doing, because they just alienate and marginalize these populations. I think that in places like Arizona, there hasn't been enough of a focus placed on really what have been effective prosecution and enforcement measures. And you have other places in the United States, like there's a city in California, Salinas, where you actually have violence breaking out in the ways that you still don't see it happening along the border. And what you have there is really the adoption of much more comprehensive law enforcement that seeks to link up with community programs, that seeks to adopt a preventive approach to violence, which is really what makes sense when you're trying to basically separate, drive wedges between populations and criminal organizations. The other thing that I would briefly like to touch on is that this problem is not just about the border. And there's currently this big perception that really the border is what you need to focus on, and really the border is the most effective choke point of an illicit trade, which doesn't mean that there's not some truth to this statement, but that's unfortunately not exactly the way this works. So it's important to consider that when you consider, for example, the Mexican drug cartels, their biggest hubs in terms of money laundering are cities that are not along the border. They're cities like Chicago or New York or Atlanta. And you also have to consider that this border doesn't just feature flows that go northward into the United States. It features flows that go south into Mexico. If you're talking about cash, money flows, we're talking about the latest estimate was $20 to $30 billion into Mexico from the United States. And the choke point metaphor breaks down even further if you consider that you don't have a couple of big players really moving all of these flows of money, but really, an army of ants. It's a sprawling organization that really just helps get this money south. So what really strikes me is the absence of a strategy to really start to deal with these problems. it's really starting to think you don't want to focus really on the easiest scapegoat, the low-lying fruit, as was mentioned earlier very appropriately, is that you have to think beyond the border, and not only beyond the border, but really beyond just the U.S. and Mexico, because I think it's been very clear historically that drug trafficking trends are very adaptive, as David was saying. So, you know, the trafficking routes shifted from the Caribbean to Mexico when enforcement improved in the Caribbean. And now that enforcement is improving along the southern border, what you see is that trafficking is relocating to back to the Caribbean, back to places in Central America. And while that means that the U.S. is going to have to develop contingencies, because you're able to enact cooperative mechanisms with Mexico, like Plan Merida, which we have seen in the past couple of years, but that's not something that is going to be able to do with a country like Jamaica, because you don't have the same degree of state capacity there. So just the other thing that I wanted to bring up is that Secretary Hillary Clinton just set off on a trip to Latin America, and she's set to give a talk in Ecuador that is supposedly going to detail the President Obama's Western Hemisphere strategy. So what I really hope to hear from that is something that will replace the vacuum of U.S. policy that has so far governed the way in which this problem is treated, really just as a very localized problem that focuses on the wrong people to target. So I'm going to just stop there, and I'd be glad to come back and discuss any of these points in the Q&A.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Dorothy, I know you've done some work on what are the consequences of some of the consequences of the current policy, and hopefully you can share some of that with us.
Yes. Thank you, Ben. And so I'm going to talk about Operation Streamline, which is one of these – it's probably the main example of a policy, a misdirected policy. And what Streamline is a zero-tolerance policy along the southwest border in certain jurisdictions where all border crossers, regardless of their criminal history, are pushed through federal district courts. So in the past, they used to be sent through the civil immigration system and were deported through that system. And now they're being placed on the dockets of federal district court and magistrate judges. And what's one of the unintended consequences of that is that the courts are incredibly overwhelmed, and it's diverting resources from prosecuting higher-level offenses. So, and the other one of the other unintended consequences is that border crossers are now hiring coyotes, as you heard, and in fact there's a study which shows that 90% of border crossers now hire coyotes. So in terms of what we did is we compared a jurisdiction, the Southern District of California, with Arizona, because the Southern District of California is one of the few districts in the southwest border area that doesn't have Operation Streamline. And what we saw was really remarkable, that the rate for prosecuting drug offenses, alien smuggling offenses, is way higher in the Southern District of California as opposed to Arizona. And this data is available on our website, www.warreninstitute.org, and you can – I won't go into all the numbers, but you can look it up there. And the other thing that we saw was that apprehensions are down both in the Southern District of California and where they have Streamline. So one of the arguments for Streamline has been, well, is that it stops border crossers. And actually, there's been nothing to show that that's the case. What it does is pushes them to coyotes and pushes them to other areas to cross. And the other issue with Streamline is it's incredibly expensive. So in Tucson alone, the government spends $52.5 million per year to detain Streamline defendants. And one of the things that the government hasn't been able to do is isolate the costs of Streamline for for us to see, you know, what is in terms of how, the amount of money, the millions and millions of dollars that is going into this program, what's the benefit? And the most important thing, I think, for this discussion is that in 2009, federal prosecutors in the border districts turned away almost 1,800 drug prosecutions, and a large percentage of those were because they said they had not enough investigative and prosecutorial resources. So what's going on here? Why don't they have enough resources? And the answer is because they're going after border crossers, whose crime is mainly crossing the border, not drug trafficking and not other high-level offenses. And that's unfortunate. And it's, I think, Streamline shows, how important it is to have a strategic, comprehensive policy instead of criminalizing folks who are really just crossing the border to get a job. Okay. I think that's it.
All right, Arthi. Thank you so much. The operator can give us some instructions, give the folks instructions on asking questions. We can go to the question and answer period.
Absolutely. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one keys on your touch-tone phone. You may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one keys now. We'll pause momentarily to allow questions to queue. And we'll take our first question from Dennis Wagner with Arizona Republic. Please go ahead.
Yeah, it's become almost a mantra among politicians, secure the border first when we're talking about immigration reform. Got to have the border secure before we can talk about that. What is a secure border? Can it be secured? What would have to be done to satisfy those who say secure the border first in order to move to the next step of reform?
All right, well, this is Ben. I'll take the first shot at that, and I think, David, then you probably have an answer. But I would say that, this border enforcement, border security, it has always been part of the strategy of an immigration reform effort. I mean, a comprehensive immigration reform, that term has become somewhat of a political term these days, but the nature of a comprehensive strategy is obviously to understand that there are many aspects of the system that aren't working right, and how do you figure out how to get them aligned and working properly together. So I think border enforcement is a critical part of this, but it has to be, in order for it to be effective, in order to get to the levels that I think David might be able to talk about in terms of benchmarks or goals, you're going to have to move the other levels as well. I mean, otherwise, I think one of the problems that we're in now is it's a self-fulfilling prophecy where the appetite for immigration reform and the demand that you have border enforcement first really becomes border enforcement only, so long as you aren't fixing the other aspects of the system. The system is working against itself. I think, as David pointed out, the absence of any measures to create to identify legitimate demand and then create legal channels for those workers to come into means that you are fighting an ever-increasingly large number of people who wouldn't otherwise be on your radar screen. So, but David, you want to speak to those issues as well?
Yeah, I think the border will never be secure enough for some people. First of all, I love the question because it's a question I think that needs to be asked to more politicians. When will it be secure enough? And I don't suppose for some legislators, until we have a giant glass dome over the United States, we'll ever have sufficient protections. But I think it's really important to take the Border Patrol at its word in some ways. I mean, they've talked for a number of years of needing to get up to capacity at this 20,000 level, and that would give them the resources that they need, the manpower that they need to do their jobs more effectively. it seems to me that the argument could be made that at this point we've gone as far as is reasonable with U.S. tax dollars to try to secure this component of the comprehensive approach. In other words, now really does fall on an immigration reform that thinks seriously about how can we create legal flows, legal avenues for people to come in, which we have not done. When we created the current immigration policy regime back in the 1960s, we said we would operate with certain quotas for that would be equitable for all countries. The reality is, though, that since the 1960s, our relationship with countries around the world has changed. No, and perhaps with no other country around the world has our relationship changed more with Mexico. We have entered into a free trade agreement that requires that promotes the free flow of capital, the free flow of goods across our borders, but we have not quite figured out how we're going to deal with the third factor of production, which is labor. And right now, I think Border Patrol's job and U.S. border security personnel's job is made more difficult by the fact that we have this huge haystack of mostly harmless people coming across the border. Last year, I think the Border Patrol apprehended somewhere over 200,000 people at the border, and of those, about 1%. About 200 people were found to be felons or have serious criminal offenses, which went unnamed. But we're talking about less than 1% of the people coming across that border that we're finding representing a serious threat to the safety of American citizens. In my view, that means we need to figure out how to get that other 99% of people out of the way. In other words, get them into some kind of legal, whether we want to debate a work visitation program or simply increasing the quota for Mexico, we need to think about other ways of making law enforcement's job easier at the border, and that means shrinking that haystack down by whatever legal means possible.
And this is Arthi. I think we also have to be careful about terminology. It's not helpful if we're painting the border crossers who don't pose a threat, as David pointed out, the vast majority of these folks, as criminal aliens. Because then what we do is we aren't able to distinguish between the folks who really are a threat. And to criminalize these folks doesn't actually help us or the situation.
Can I follow up briefly?
Yes. Hello? Yes, go ahead.
Nobody answered my question. What is a secure border?
David again. I mean, I think that, again, I don't have an answer for you because I don't think that personally there is an answer.
Mm-hmm.
I think politicians use this idea of a secure border as a kind of phantom menace, or rather the idea of the border as a kind of phantom menace to say, we have this unreachable goal that we want to get to, and as long as we aren't there, we can continue to invest in this vast border industrial complex that are the various companies that are benefiting from the contracts to build up border fencing, build up border walls, provide us with surveillance equipment that doesn't always work, build us predator aircraft to fly along the border and to make this border. Honestly, I don't think the border, we have more security at the border than ever before, as I've said. But I don't think that the border itself is less penetrable than ever before. Go ahead, please. I guess the bottom line is I don't see this this ideal border scenario ever realizing itself where no one can get across the border without detection or without being apprehended by U.S. authorities. That to me is perhaps what they have in mind, this idea of an impenetrable border. But there is no such animal, I don't think that's an achievable goal given that We have found literally dozens, if not, I think, hundreds of tunnels at this point in the last 15 years since the start of NAFTA. We have seen submersibles used to move people into U.S. territory and particularly drugs. We've seen aircraft used. I don't think that you can create an impenetrable border. And so you have to, I think, use techniques that will enhance the capacity of law enforcement to identify threats at the border and to act on those quickly and not waste their time with non-threats.
Yes, this is Jennifer. I think that's absolutely right. There's only so far that you're going to be able to go. And I think to some degree the government has recognized that. At the very top, the federal government has recognized that you need to move beyond this notion of just a border that is impenetrable towards, you know, the 21st century border. And I think some progress was made in that respect in terms of the recent talks that have taken place between the U.S. government and the Mexican government, where really they appear to be moving towards this different set of standards, whereas the border that you want is not one that is just sealed down, but it's one where you can have an efficient, effective passage of people, of flows of goods, while minimizing the degree to which you're going to have illegal goods and the degree to which you're going to have violence. But I completely agree that the problem is that that's not a vision that is widely embraced. Instead, there's this notion that it has to be one where there's this moving target that basically says that there needs to be no flow of drugs, no flow of illegal immigrants. And really that only creates a more insecure border, because what you have are illegal immigrants who end up dying trying to persistently access more remote areas of the border in order to get through. And on the other hand, you just have criminal organizations that, as David was saying, are willing to utilize absolutely every method of transportation to get goods across. And whether that's subterranean or in the air, we're talking, you know, low-flying aircraft, the works. I think it's a good question, but it's one that unfortunately, you know, is very difficult to answer at this point.
I also, this is David again, I just want to throw one thing out there. One thing that nobody really talks about when we're looking specifically at undocumented immigration is that a very significant percentage of undocumented immigrants wind up in the United States. They come to the United States legally and then overstay their visas. And so they're not even walking across that border. And it strikes me as a little bit disingenuous of the anti-immigration camp to focus on the border when we don't have very good data on this, but some people estimate between 40 and 60% of undocumented immigrants in the United States.
Right, right.
Are people who came in legally and simply overstayed their visa. So much of this is sort of smoke and mirrors at the border. And I don't think that we're really trying to address the root of the problem when we talk about just beefing up the border.
Right, I completely agree.
Mm-hmm.
I completely agree that there's this false focus on the border, and of course, you know, the problem is that even when you have folks who come over here and overstay their visas, you know, then it's more difficult for. I mean, they don't have incentives to leave, right?
Well, because okay, let's try to. I know there's other questions that are out there. Sorry, that was a good question. Let's move on to the next one.
Absolutely, our next question comes from Cece Connolly with Washington Post. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to return to the question of spillover violence. I know one of you, I think David, maybe said that some of those border communities are safer than they've been in quite some time, or the safest in the U.S. Is there anyone that has good, real data on this question? And if we're not seeing spillover violence in the border communities, are we seeing it elsewhere in the United States? I mean, what's happening if we're dealing with highly sophisticated criminal organizations with large sums of money at stake and large numbers of weapons? Wouldn't we expect some violence somewhere?
Well, let me frame that just in terms of its the disconnectedness of the violence issue from the immigration issue and use that as a way to talk about decreasing crime rates, because many of the places that are hubs of for immigration, including illegal immigration, meaning that the immigrants are moving through the border up to other places in Chicago and in Los Angeles and those areas. And studies that we've done at the Immigration Policy Center have shown that where you have higher levels of immigration, you actually have a reverse correlation with crime, which is, I think, reflects really 100 years of study that's looked at this issue of immigration and crime and shown that immigrants themselves are less likely to commit crime than even the native-born. So I think, you know, in answering that question, part of what we have to do is disconnect it from this issue of immigration. But Jennifer, you or David, do you have any thoughts on where those violent
I would be glad to take this question because that's actually one of the main things, you know, that it's important to clarify in this whole thing is, well, okay, we're worried about the spillover. The spillover, is it happening? If it's not happening at the border, then where? And it seems like right now the problem is that it's very difficult to tell. What has been established is that you don't have this sort of linear spillover at the border. I think that's something that has been agreed to by, if you look at data from border communities, from police departments. And to the best of my knowledge, across the country, the most comprehensive sort of data mining project that has been done has been by the Congressional Research Service, trying to really determine whether there's a correlation between the level of activities that they register by organized criminal groups, by international cartels, and crime. And at the moment, it's just too difficult to tell. But I think because you have some places where crime has been increasing in places like Atlanta, and I think that's really something that is very difficult to keep in mind at this moment when you're formulating policy, is that the spillover hasn't happened right now, but what you really want to do is develop the best mechanisms to hedge against it. And also, I think a very important thing to keep in mind is that the spillover may not come in the form that people always expect it to. So you may not have widespread violence across the border, but something that has been documented by agencies like ICE or like CBP is that they have registered more and more attempts to corrupt agents. So they have had to lay off more of their agents on charges of corruption because they have realized that there are attempts to directly infiltrate them by criminal cartels. And I think that's something that is very important to keep in mind, that maybe, you know, where exactly will that threshold be crossed into armed violence, and if the United States really is the sort of country where you're just not going to see the same sort of open warfare as you see in Mexico, then what are the alternative mechanisms that criminal groups are going to take to try to nonetheless get away with their illicit trade?
This is David Shirk. I'm just going to jump in here on this question as well. I mean, the study that Jennifer mentioned, I think, is a very important one to be aware of. And back in February this year, the Congressional Research Service produced a study called Southwest Border Violence, Issues in Identifying and Measuring Spillover Violence. And I think the number one issue when we talk about spillover violence is that there is no legal definition of what spillover is. Congress has not adopted a formal definition, according to the report, and there are different agency definitions. All of the definitions I think that are out there are very careful, and I shouldn't say all of them. The definitions that the U.S. government is using are very careful in how they describe it. The DEA, for example, says that spillover violence entails deliberate, planned attacks by cartels on U.S. assets, including civilian, military, or law enforcement officials, innocent U.S. Citizens, or physical institutions such as government buildings, consulates, etc. It does not include traffic or on-traffic or violence, whether perpetrated in the U.S. or Mexico. That definition narrows the concept of spillover violence so that if you have a trafficker kidnap another trafficker or a member of a cartel down in Chula Vista, which did happen in San Diego about 2 years ago, that wouldn't count as spillover violence. And I guess the thing that makes me uncomfortable with the use of the terminology is that, as was said earlier, the reality is that there are many different manifests. Drug trafficking is a transnational activity, and there are many different manifestations of that activity on both sides of the border. But what we clearly have not seen, when we talk about the violence, we have not seen efforts to assassinate U.S. Government personnel or elected leaders. We have not seen decapitations or dismemberment of bodies or narco messages or any of the kind of very high-profile violence that constitutes the current kind of narco violence that we're documenting on in our institute, and I think many people are focused on in Mexico. And we have certainly seen, you know, you see street level violence, you see corruption, as was mentioned earlier, of U.S. Border Patrol and other U.S. agents. But we're not talking, when you look at what's happening in Mexico, it is an entirely different phenomenon than anything we're seeing in the United States right now. And that has a lot to do with the fact that we have a much more effective public security apparatus in the United States. We have a much higher degree of rule of law in the United States. And that stops at the border, not because of the border fence, but because of 50 years of professionalization of U.S. law enforcement, the dramatic strengthening of the U.S. criminal justice system, and our very effective mechanisms for fighting organized crime in the United States, many of these aspects which are just being developed or just starting to develop in Mexico. It's going to be another decade or so before those get fully developed south of the border. So the term, I think, is, again, one of these leading terms that makes it very difficult for us to get purchase on a complex set of problems. But the bottom line is, when you measure it according to the way the U.S. government measures spillover violence, the number of incidents is extremely small or negligible. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that report.
All right. So, again, I'll come back to the point that wherever that violence that flows from drug trades and the trade in guns, wherever it manifests itself, fighting it is significantly more difficult as long as we are continuing to lump in immigrants who are really sort of the byproduct of a broken immigration system rather than drug cartels. So, you know, having to deal with people who are otherwise seeking family unification or legitimate employment in the United States, dealing with them in the same way that we deal with those kinds of drug cartels makes our efforts incredibly inefficient. Let me say before we go to the next question that anyone who wants to reach any of the speakers for additional follow-up can contact Wendy Sefsaf here at the American Immigration Council. Her number is 202-507-7524. We have another question?
Yes, we'll take our next question from Emily Cadet with the Congressional Quarterly. Please go ahead.
Hi, this question was specifically about Operation Streamline. I was just hoping to get some reaction because I know this is something that Senator Kyle specifically has made a big issue of, and he cites statistics showing that in Tucson, apprehensions are still very high, whereas in Yuma, they've dropped off, and saying that shows that Operation Streamline isn't effective. And so I was just wondering if RT might be able to comment on that argument and why or why not that's a valid point.
RT, can you give us a
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to talk about that. Well, it depends on, you know, your definition of effective. If you're talking about that particular jurisdiction, perhaps you could say yes, there have been – first of all, there's a couple of issues. One is apprehensions. Our data seems to is showing that apprehensions are going down with demand for workers in the United States and with the economy. So that's one issue. So secondly, just because folks are not going through Yuma doesn't mean that they're not still trying to cross the border. And just because they're being prosecuted through Streamline doesn't mean that they're not returning. And in fact, the data for 2010 seems to be showing that now there's more prosecutions for illegal reentry, which means that folks have been prosecuted through Streamline and they're still trying to cross the border. So the effectiveness of this program, I think, is still in question based on the data that we've seen. So does that answer your question?
All right. She might not have been on the line there. All right. Next question. Thanks, Arthi.
Sure.
Absolutely. Our next question comes from Matthew Harwood with Security Management Magazine. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. Just a general question. I wanted to know what you think is the best way for the United States to stop gun smuggling from the United States into Mexico without interfering with gun rights too much, which will be a hot, you know, button issue on the, in the border states.
This is David. I'll take a first stab at that one. One of the things that we see when you look at the seizure of guns south of the border in Mexico is a very pronounced tendency to find higher-powered, more assault-type weapons on the eastern corridor of Mexico compared to, say, Baja California. And I think that one of the major contributing factors to the variance in the pattern of weapons or firearm flows into Mexico has to do with state-level gun control laws and enforcement. And I mean, there are other factors, importantly, the fact that there's a significantly higher degree of violence on the Eastern Corridor, and there are sort of lots of things that we can point to. But the fact that California has much stricter laws with regard to purchasing firearms, and particularly these high-powered and convertible assault-type weapons, I think it speaks very strongly in favor of the remarks that President Calderon made when he was here a couple of weeks ago, that some kind of more significant effort to control assault weapons in the United States is going to be necessary. Now, the question is, does that violate the rights of U.S. gun owners, the vast majority of whom do not own assault-type weapons or convertible weapons, for example, an AK-type weapon that has been converted to single shot, but which can be converted back by the drug traffickers to a full-bore assault-type weapon. I think most Americans don't want to have those kinds of weapons in the hands of Mexican drug traffickers, kids in the schools like Columbine, but there's a very powerful drug lobby that conflates what would be considered by many people to be reasonable Second Amendment gun rights, right to own a hunting rifle, right to have a weapon for self-defense. They conflate those fairly valid types of issues with these more high-powered and more dangerous weapons that even many police associations in the United States feel should not be on the street, should not be available to the U.S. consumers. But, you know, I think it's a really tough, politically, it's really tough to get beyond those narrow interests and come up with a measure that's going to be palatable to, or that's going to pass through Congress. But I think it's, I mean, Mexicans are literally dying as a result of this sort of iron river of weapons flowing south. It is, I think it's really rather offensive to Mexico. I think Mexican officials tend to be offended by the idea that the United States can't do more or won't do more to address the issue. On the other hand, I think in the United States, the issue of gun possession and gun rights is akin to what in Mexico we might see if we tried to privatize oil rights. That's how I try to explain it when I'm talking to a Mexican audience. Imagine if the United States came to Mexico and said, you need to privatize oil. Mexicans would go completely ballistic would completely object to that idea coming from the United States. And so I can understand the resentment on the U.S. side. The thing is, oil, well, I was going to say oil doesn't kill, but recent events might contradict that. But when you look at the toll that these guns are having in Mexico, our organization tracks the gun violence in Mexico, the drug-related homicides in Mexico, using some fairly conservative measures. And, you know, since the Calderon administration has taken office, you have around 20,000 homicides that have occurred, many of those from U.S. weapons. It's really hard, I think, to deal honestly with Mexico and say, we want you to help us to continue to fight this effort, but we're not going to stop arming the people that you're fighting by clamping down a little bit more on our own southbound flows of guns.
I'm going to just 30 seconds very quickly agree with David and say that I think there are a number of low-hanging fruit measures that the U.S. Has not taken to counter the weapons trafficking that it could easily take, and I think other countries in the region would like to see even a gesture. And what comes to mind for me is something like the Inter-American Convention Against Manufacturing and Trafficking in Firearms, which would be a treaty that would make it easier to trace illegally manufactured weapons. And it's something that the U.S. has stalled on ratifying for years now, even though it was signed back when back in the time of President Clinton. And I think even something like that would be an opening. But as David said, what you see is instead the conflating of this issue with the issue of gun rights, and that's, of course, when you run into a huge impasse.
All right. Do we have another question? We'll take one more.
I'm showing at this time we have no further questions. Excellent. I'd like to go ahead and turn it back over to Mr. Johnson.
All right. Well, thank you all very much. Again, if anyone would like to reach out to any of the speakers, you can reach them through Wendy Sefsaf, who is at our office, the American Immigration Council, 202-507-7524. Thank you all for participating, and we look forward to more of these conferences to talk about these important issues.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.